So the topic that I chose, fits with that last question around breaking the addiction to our minds. And I don't know if you think about yourself as a mind addict. I don't know if you are offended by me assuming that you are ready to break the denial and acknowledge and raise your hand and say, you know, I'm an addict to my mind. First, I think addiction, it's an interesting word that maybe we should define, and lots of different people probably would define it differently. I would define addiction as something like any repetitive, kind of compulsive and repetitive behavior that causes harm. So there are some repetitive behaviors that are not harmful, and I wouldn't call them addiction. Some people say, well, I'm addicted to breathing. Well, I don't think that breathing is harmful, actually, so I wouldn't classify it as an addiction. And then there are some addictions that, repetitive, compulsive behaviors that cause harm that we can actually abstain from. You know, so like people that become addicted to drugs, like myself, I can abstain from, total abstinence, complete renunciation. I don't take drugs, period. I haven't for decades now. I've abstained from that behavior that caused myself and others harm. But then there's other kinds of addictions, like I think the best example is a food addiction, where your relationship to food has become repetitive, compulsive, and it has caused you harm. Or overeating, or some kind of bulimia, or some kind of relationship to food that is harmful in relationship to the body, that's a repetitive compulsive. But you cannot abstain from food. I feel like I hate standing up, but I don't like not being able to see you. I feel like I can't see half of the room. Standing up, I feel like I'm lecturing or something. Class. So when you think about your relationship to your mind, can you see some ways that there's been this compulsive habit of taking it all pretty personally, and the mind that judges or compares or worries, or some habits in your mind that have caused you harm? Is that too much of an assumption? I don't think you'd be trying to meditate if your mind wasn't kind of causing you some harm, right? If there wasn't some problem, then we probably wouldn't get motivated to practice meditation. Now, maybe that's not totally true for everyone, but it certainly has been true for me. And I feel like it's a lot of what the Buddha was pointing to and teaching in the reason for a meditative training. Because of our identification, or what we could call addiction to the mind, and taking it all so personal, is one of the reasons why we suffer so much. I would say that human suffering, personal suffering anyways, the internal kind, comes in three categories. A lack of compassion, or a resistance to the unpleasant experience that we're having. Right? A lack of compassion is what, because there's pain. Pain is unavoidable, we're going to have it. And if we meet pain with compassion, no suffering, just pain. And the other side is pleasure, our repetitive craving, attachment, clinging, which is really what's fueling the mind most of the time. If you look at your mind, what are you usually thinking about? What are all of these plans? What are all of these worries? What are all of these doubts? If you boil them down, isn't it usually the mind is doing something about how can I get pleasure? What will be make me happy, aka what will be pleasant? Some survival instinct-driven mind that's constantly craving. That's just the nature of the biological evolution of the human human being. And the third, so I'd say our relationship to pleasure is a third of the problem. Our relationship to pain is a third of the problem. And then the self-centeredness, the taking it all personal. And in some ways, there's different Buddhist approaches. Some Buddhists will say, actually, if we just go to, like, don't take it personal, the not-self, the emptiness of a self, if you can just see through the fact that this is really not your fault, that this whole thing is not so personal. This is just the human condition. There's not really an I, a me in there. When you, under deep investigation, you won't find a permanent fixed self, even though we feel like that. We feel like, oh, it's my mind. So there's a lot of Buddhists that would go through that emptiness door or not self door. And it's a very important core teaching of the Buddha. My own tendency is to not too quickly go to that, but to more focus on how can we develop compassion for the pain in our lives and the compassion for the pain in this world. And then more on that relative, like, I think it's totally okay to take it personal for now. Right? Totally okay to take it personal for now and to say, like, this is really my pain. This is really my addictive pattern that is causing me and other people suffering. I don't want to take full responsibility for it. I don't want to go too quickly to the impersonal, because we can use that to avoid rather than take responsibility. So the first meditation instruction is ignore your mind and pay attention to your body. Stop thinking about it and just drop your attention into the sensation. Breathing in, know you're breathing in. Breathing out, know you're breathing out. But what happens when you try to do that? How much success are you having? How long can you go without getting lost again, drawn back into? Like, if this was an abstinence-based process, meditation was like, don't think. How long tonight before you relapsed? I got like 2 breaths of abstinence and then total relapse into thinking. And then I got 3 breaths and then total relapse. And then I got 4 breaths and then back into that habitual identification of the mind planning and remembering and hoping and fearing and everything that our minds do, or being creative, or, you know, the mind can be so seductive. How many of your minds tonight during meditation complimented you? I'm doing pretty good at this. I'm not thinking about anything. I got this meditation. Oh, shit. The mind kind of tricking you, like, I'm not thinking. Totally paying attention to the breath. First instruction I would see is some level of, if we can break our identification, if we can learn to ignore the mind, and again, not stop it. And this is where it's really quite tricky or subtle, I think, because it's, the instruction, the way that I'm hearing, is not saying stop the mind, but saying stop paying attention to the mind. Break your identification with it. You can't just, like, you tell it to stop and your mind says something rude. Like, you think you're in control? You think you can just make me stop? And you see this sort of tyrant in the mind that says, I've got all kinds of resentments to rehash right now while you're meditating. You go ahead and meditate. I've got plans. I've got ideas. I've got, you know, all, I'm total inspiration. I, I've got some feedback for Noah. I've got, the mind continues. The mind has a mind of its own. One of the first insights that often we have is like, oh, that's not... I thought... I've been taking this all personal. I thought that's who I was before I started meditating. And then I started meditating. I was like, oh, my mind has no shame, has no... It's not actually who I am. And the meditative process that allows us to start having some discernment. Like what the Buddha talks about, wholesome thoughts. Because and this is why it's like it can't be an abstinence. Because the brain is so useful, actually, being able to analyze and reflect and learn and have knowledge. And it's such an important and necessary part of our existence, our brains. And so we can't just ignore them forever. We can't abstain from thought. But through first being able to put it down, saying, okay, I'm gonna actually try to fast. I've become addicted to food, and so I'm actually going to have some fasting. I've become addicted to my mind, so I am going to try to ignore it for some time. And then when I've done that, now I'm going to try to find a balanced relationship to it, some discernment around how I relate to it, and what thoughts are wholesome. There's wisdom that arises in the mind. There's love, there's compassion that arises in the mind that we want to pay attention to. Right? And kind of looking at what's arising, what is the intention behind this thought? Is there a positive intention? Is this a thought that is worth following? Or is this a more negative, unwholesome, instinctual drives that are going to actually lead to suffering that I could set aside, that I could maybe ignore or try to... The Buddha talks about trying to replace it, try to replace it with a loving, a kind, a compassionate thought, trying to set it aside or ignore it. So that it's not an abstinence, but that it's a new way of relating to our minds. When I first meditated, I saw this for myself, and I saw that I didn't know until I meditated that it was actually possible to ignore my mind. I don't know if you knew that. I didn't know that. I had spent the first half of my life obeying my mind. And my mind had such bad advice for me. So many bad ideas. So much lust and violence and just craving that fueled my mind. And then I just obeyed it. And my mind said, steal, and I stole. And my mind said, hurt somebody, and I hurt somebody. And my mind said, take drugs every single day. And I took drugs every single day. And all of that was because I had no relationship to, like, oh, I'm not going to do that. That's a terrible idea. And it wasn't until I started meditating and saw, oh, I can ignore, I can come back to the breath. I don't have to obey that thought. I don't have to be addicted to or like a servant to my own mind. I can defy it. Meditation teaches that. That's, we can have some defiance over some of those bad ideas, unwise, instinctual drives, addictions. I don't have to follow them. There's this core philosophy that I pointed to in the beginning of the class around Buddhism as a refuge, as taking refuge. Like I said, we take refuge in the potential of becoming awake, of waking up. And for me, taking refuge in Buddha, I would say, is simply seeing clearly. Buddha to me means when we're seeing reality as it is. Not distorted, not diluted, but seeing reality as it right now, it's like this, and it feels like this, and seeing clearly. And then also responding appropriately to what we know, to what we see. And so that means if it's painful, appropriate response is compassion, is loving kindness, is friendliness. So seeing, oh, there's this pain in me or in someone else in this world, and the appropriate response is to care about it. Our own pain and the pain of others. Seeing, so this is when I think about taking refuge, is taking refuge in that potential that we all have to see clearly and to respond in the appropriate way, the wise way. And taking refuge in the Dharma. Different ways to think about it, but right now I'm thinking about it as the Dharma is these instructions, like we were talking about, the guided, the things that are going to teach us to see clearly. The practices, the discipline, the teachings that are going to teach me to pay attention, that are going to teach us to develop compassion, that are going to teach us to develop non-attachment, taking refuge in a disciplined practice that will allow us to see more and more clearly and to respond more and more wisely. And then the community, taking refuge in like-minded, revolutionary thinkers and practitioners and people who are actually trying to be kind, trying to be wise, and trying to be awake, Sangha community. The Buddha calls, in the suttas, he talks about people who don't have a meditation practice as untrained worldlings. That's a good diss, right? An untrained worldling. And he says, and the people that haven't trained, they haven't actually checked out their own mind and saw what's really going on in here and don't have that self-knowledge. He said, the untrained worldlings go around with their views and opinions annoying people. Because they just believe their mind and they're addicted to it, and they just, you know, they don't, if there's not actual wisdom there, because without the deep introspection of actually seeing, oh, everything's impermanent. Oh, there's all of this self-centeredness that the mind creates. There's all of this aversion to pain, to other, this fear. And when you meditate, you see that, and then you stop taking it so personally. Because maybe it's, I don't know if it, how much of it's societal conditioning around like get an education and be a critical thinker. And I think some of it's society, but maybe some of it's just human survival instinct that kind of encourages us to trust our mind. To take refuge in your own intelligence. You'll think your way through life. You'll figure it out. You'll think your way through it, that there's this kind of, maybe even some of the Western philosophical tradition or education tradition that puts all of this emphasis on trust your own mind. Do you feel like you got that message, that you should be able to figure it out without meditating? You don't need to meditate, just think, you know. And even people use the term, like, I'll meditate on that. Think, like, I'll think about it. I'll think my way to the solution. Is it possible? I know in recovery, in 12-step recovery, I heard somewhere along the way that you can't think your way to right action, but you can act your way to right thinking. And I think that that's part of what's being said in Buddhism, is that you cannot think your way to wisdom and compassion. You can't do it just by, you have to first break our addiction to thinking in order to then train the mind to respond to pain, because it's so counter-instinctual. And just the untrained thinking mind hates pain. It's a survival instinct. We hate pain. It's not our fault. We're just born into a body and a mind that just despises unpleasantness because it threatens our survival, our security. We love pleasure. We're just born into these minds that are constantly looking for the next fix. What will be pleasant? What will lead to some sense of security and safety and happiness, a.k.a. a pleasant experience? I don't have much judgment of that. That's what my mind is doing all of the time. And I think it's just the way that it is. But having some discernment about it and some, oh, I can't always trust this, that sometimes my mind's going to have some quite bad advice for me about how to get that pleasure, or who to, you know, who to sleep with, or who to, you know, how to relate to money, or whatever it is, some kind of delusional ideas about happiness. So if we've been taking refuge in our mind, thinking that's, I'll figure it out, and Buddhism offers us this path that says, well, the untrained mind, not so trustworthy. But that through effort, taking refuge in the Dharma, the practices, the discipline practice, the mind eventually will become an ally. That you will train it. And wisdom will arise in the mind. You break your addiction to it. And then it's semantics, I guess, but it's tricky because we're training the mind with the mind. You can't just not think. You have to train the mind with the mind. And then eventually, the trained mind becomes wisdom mind, compassion mind. Maybe it's neuroscience. Maybe what it is that the untrained mind hates pain and just pushes it away and judges it and fears it and worries about it and doubts it. And that the trained mind, then we start saying, actually, I want to be compassionate, and we create these new neural pathways. Compassion, just by trying. Okay, I don't want to hate pain, even though that's natural to me, because hating it makes it worse. I don't want to do that. So I keep having this aspiration, may I meet this with friendliness, may I meet this with compassion. And that repetitive intention actually creates a neural pathway in the brain, where the brain starts to think kind, compassionate, loving thoughts, even towards our own pain, not just others. So perhaps it's as simple as neuroscience. There was, simple, like neuroscience. There was a teaching from the Buddha where he said, somebody asked him, well, how is this working? I'm trying to bring my attention back to the breath or to compassion. And he uses the analogy, he said, there's a stone. And you're dropping water on that stone, just a drip at a time. And the first few, it feels like they just splash off. But actually, if you drop the water in the same place on that stone over and over and over, eventually there'll be an indentation. And eventually, if you do that for like 10 years, there'll actually be a groove. It will actually create a groove in the stone, you know, like the Grand Canyon or something like that, where over the years and years and years, water will cut through the earth. It will cut through something hard. He used that, and it's like that. He knew neuroscience. He's like, oh, there's neuroplasticity that if you give, you know, if you do this repetitive act of mindfulness or of kindness or of compassion, it will create a habit, a groove in the mind, where you will become present, you will become compassionate. It will, you know, that's actually how it works, through repetition. Does it make sense? Have I confused you?